Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome to X-Tax and Jax. I'm Tim Howell. Andrew on the board. We've got all kinds of stuff going on. We got a government shutdown. We got the market down some. We got the S&P's down 39. NASDAQ futures down 167. Dow futures down 235. Dow futures tumbled 200 points in fears of drawn-out shutdown that hurts the economy. So there you have it. We have the Trump administration trying to get $500 million out of Harvard. Not exactly sure why or where that money's going, but you know, I guess it's for the common good. Anyway, do we have Professor Kevin?
You do. How's the sound?
You sound okay.
Okay, because something's. You're not coming out of my my conference speaker, and I just want to check something.
I would blame Andrew.
This is on my side.
Oh, don't say it. Just say it's Andrew's fault.
Hey, I actually wanted to say I think the sound quality is a little better today. I think it's sounding good.
Okay. Well, I'm generally of a mind that it works better.
Well, now you're not on, so you just muted thyself.
Maybe I spoke too soon.
Microsoft phone. Select a speaker. Any sound now?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. All right, we're good.
Cubs win. A couple of guys were at the game. Bars were full after. A lot of people in their Cub outfits. it caused my buddy Bill and I all kinds of consternation as we had to go from saloon to saloon, which we don't want to do. Hate it when that happens. Just saying.
Yeah, you've never had to go to multiple saloons before.
Well, you know, we have our routine. And the Tripoli, you couldn't walk in the door because of the Boston fans. You know, I'm not a... It's hard to be one of these guys where you say you're not really a Boston detractor, and the next thing you say is, boy, I can't stand those people. But it's not like... I haven't seen a person in there for a Boston game all year. Yesterday, the place is mobbed, screaming and yelling like they actually care about the team. Every play, they're the loudest people on earth. And something they don't... Only if they're a playoff team. I didn't see them play all year. I didn't see a Boston fan. I used to see them all the time. Because it was
so
a Boston.
You're telling me they're a bunch of front runners, is what you're saying.
Is the mortal words of my buddy JD, who you know, bunch of good time Charlies. Just saying.
Well, what can you say? We're used to Chicago, where we're perpetually pissed and let me put it this way: we're almost like you have to watch the train wreck sometimes.
So I ended up going to two places that I never went before. We have a new there was an Italian place I went to for years, and they closed up, and these other guys opened to join up. So I go in there, and we go, you guys have a couple seats at the bar so we can, like, get a drink? Oh, no, you can't sit at the bar. We're full. Okay. So we go to this other place that is always mobbed. It's some kind of British sort of thing, and the food evidently is pretty good. But you can't get in a place. The prices are absolutely to the moon. And just to say, Kevin, it's sort of not our kind of place, so we managed to get a couple of seats at the bar in there. And Bill tells me, well, you know, this place is pretty good, but they're pricey. So I go through the drink menu. Ended up with a, what the hell did I have? I had a Canadian Club on the racks. Well, that was $17. Everything else was like $30. You know, every bottle of wine was like $80. So I sure as hell don't need a bottle by myself. Food is so. This guy sits down next to us.
Besides, they're not going to serve it to you in a brown bag like you usually.
Yeah, I know. So this guy sits down next to me. Doesn't know anybody. Doesn't say hello to the bartender. And he sits down, and orders some, you know, $30 drink, a $30 burger. This is in the neighborhood. Wolfs the burger down in maybe 2.5 minutes, slugs the drink, pays his like $80 tab, and walks out the door. I'm going, God, there's a guy happy with the people around him. So then,
For that kind of money, I would think that you would want to kind of relax and enjoy it.
Oh, no, there's no TV in there. You can't watch, so he couldn't watch the other game. Not one. And so finally, Jimmy went to the game. Jimmy Lawler, our producer on Monday and Thursday, was at the game, and he said, hey, come on down to Kincaid's down the block. There's plenty of room. So we got down there, and finally we were okay. But God, it was traumatic. Traumatic, Kevin. So now the worst thing is, all the judges, you know, Mike Tillman, who is an incredible judge and interesting guy, and actually we've talked about him on the show a bunch because in today's world, without getting into the politics of it, let's just say it's harder to be a judge because it's becoming more of a political thing, or has become some. And Mike was one of those guys that always was this tough little Irish guy, former Marine. You couldn't intimidate him no matter what you did, right? And I wonder, Kevin, in today's world, he was also single. His family, his brother and sister, I think, moved to California. So there was nobody around you could intimidate him with. I just wonder if he would have had a family, you know, kids in school, if he would have been happy to take the Jeff Fort murder trial where they had to put, you know, police on his block to protect him and that kind of stuff. I wonder if he would have. I wonder if anybody who has people you care about in today's world would want those jobs. And, I mean, if it's yourself, it's one thing. You can have stones for yourself, but it's another thing to have stones for your family. I wonder how much of, you know, Mike's independence was because it was just him. And I thought about that more every time I see, you know, somebody threatened or something like that, and or shot, as we're seeing it all over the damn place. What is this? Wait, I'm probably talking about changes. What is this hang up with religion, where people are shooting people, Mormon places, Catholic places? What is religion doing to anybody that anybody wants to shoot people there? I don't get that at all. Out of all the other things, I don't get.
Because religion is not by definition political, except that it often is, and. So I think that's part of what you're seeing there is, and some of it, you know, God knows. I mean, this last guy, this last shooting in Michigan, shooting up the Mormon church, I really haven't paid a lot of attention to what that was about, you know, what his background was and such. The only bits I know is, you know, he's a veteran, he's... you know, he's divorced. You know, he may have been, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, there may be PTSD issues, there may be personal relationship issues, all kinds of things that have damaged the guy's life. So when we talk about people who are damaged, that's, you know, he would fit the profile just from the 10 minutes I saw of anything about him. So we do have a lot of damaged people for all kinds of reasons. You know, we should be wary of veterans. We really should, because we've sent so many people off to war, and they've seen so many horrible things. And we even saw that out of the Vietnam era. So, you know, I don't know why anything else that we've done in the recent years would be any different. So we have those kinds of issues where we have to deal with it. And then, you know, then we start sending messages to people, you know, as we, you know, in the political world, as we demonize people, and whether you're calling them, you know, Hitler, Nazis, jackbooted thugs, whatever you're doing is you start to give permission to people to the crazies, because, you know, it's the crazies that, you know, they're going to go off. And and they pick up on these messages and they react to it in a way. Because if you, you know, if you're talking about somebody's Hitler, or you're talking about somebody is an existential threat to democracy, then all of a sudden you're telling the crazies that we better do something about this, because we're in trouble.
Hitler shot him, I assume, was it me?
I don't know where this particular shooting fits in, but you know, Charlie Kirk, for instance, in his case, a whole lot of what he discussed was founded in his Christian faith.
Well, and what stuff we talk about is founded in ours.
I know.
But I mean, I guess if I've actually. My buddy Dr. J had a buddy that was Mormon, so I learned more about Mormon than I cared to, and went to the temple out there, and I was impressed, and I was also very impressed with my economic mind, that if you're in Utah and you want to get ahead economically, you better be Mormon. I mean, you're not going to get a major contract without being in a Mormon church, at least in those days you didn't. So I could see, not to the point where you would ever shoot anybody, I could see somebody out there not liking the fact that it wasn't all that even if you weren't in the church. All right, that doesn't mean you ever kill anybody or shoot them or anything like that. You know that. I mean, I would never do that. But there at least would be, you know, some sort of a reason that I could have been a contender, you know, if you were Marlon Brando. I could have been a road construction guy, but by the way, I'm not Mormon, so I never got a job. That may, in fact, have happened out there. But the idea, how would I even know where the Mormon church is in Illinois, for God's sake, to go shoot somebody? And why would I ever feel like I was harmed by a Mormon person in Illinois or Michigan?
Yeah, and so in this case, I don't know what that connection is in the Michigan shooting. I just don't know. I will tell you, yeah, you're absolutely right about, you know, needing to be connected to the faith. We actually didn't, we talked about this not too long ago, where once upon a time, your faith, whether it was parishes, whether, you know, whatever, you know, various faiths will call their gathering points or their, you know, their churches, that was sort of the center of social life.
Sure.
In many cases, and it was the center of a lot of business life in many cases. And we've gotten away from that as we fragmented, as fewer people practice their faith, as the neighborhoods broke up, because this was, especially in the cities, was neighborhood by neighborhood, and there were a lot of ties in there. That is still the case, though, for the Mormon faith. And so, if you have known anybody who's Mormon, you know that they are very, very closely aligned with the others. Whether they're, what do they call it? You know, the equivalent of their church, or the equivalent of a parish. I'm not sure what that is. Yeah, I don't know the right terminology, and I apologize for,
I'm standing in the temple. Well, you can't get in.
But the point is that it is, in many ways, still has that same kind of thing that we remember from our childhood about how people manage to intertwine their social and their faith and their business and all of that.
It was the neighborhood.
It's still true in that faith, very much so, where we've gotten away from that in, for instance, Catholicism.
Well, the community part, I mean, there always was the Father's Club meeting once a month, the Mother's Club meeting, all those kinds of things all happened in the parish hall.
Yeah, at least once a month, in the church basement, a big social event.
Or a band, you had a sock hop, you go over and you could, it was a dance every Friday night, so you didn't have to go out in the neighborhood to. But it was kind of funny, Kevin. This guy, he was pretty much a weird duck, not because he was Mormon. I think he was weird no matter what. Somehow or other, we went out skiing and we were going to meet this guy. I was never a big fan. But so I show up at the temple, And, you know, the temple's pretty impressive, but you can't get in the real part of the temple where only the Mormons can go, but you can be in, like, the tourist part.
Yep. And, yeah, I've been there.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I'm standing there, and this guy walks up to me, and then I was young, and he was, you know, maybe in his 60s. Oh, can I help you? Well, I'm just kind of waiting for a friend. Well, I can be a friend. And I'm going, what's... No. A Southside guy, that's like, wait a minute. you know how that goes over, Kevin.
Nervous, doesn't it?
And so I talked about 30 seconds. I couldn't wait to get away from him. So this guy, my guy I knew, walks in. He goes, that guy runs the biggest construction company in Utah. Just donates time to the church. And I'm thinking, now, if I had my brokerage firm at the time, I might have said, hey, wait a minute. Here's a client. But I didn't. And
I'm back. Hey, friend.
Yeah, hey, friend, yeah. So then, of course, this guy's buddy, good-looking guy, got this gorgeous wife, you know, the 3-4 kids, and he sells radio time. Now, can you imagine Stocks and Jocks doing this? He sells radio time for the Mormon radio station and just goes from one person to the church to the other. Gee, do you think he ever got a sale? And the wife, you know, wife donated time at the church. They got a beautiful house, a couple of nice cars. I'm going, this isn't a bad dude. Whatever. No, I don't, I'm sure I just...
You know, and what I'm saying is, as I describe it, and pretty inartfully, but nevertheless, as I describe it is, you know, I do have a lot of respect for that. I think there's, you know, it's a throwback to something that I think added a lot of value, that when you talked yes. about church and you talked about faith, you were also talking about community. And that, you know, I think that was a kind of a big deal.
Plus, everybody was busy, Kevin. You had something to do.
Yeah, and I think we miss a certain amount of that. It's not coming back, so I'm not suggesting that we need to, you know, reconstruct everything.
No.
But it is something that was really part of the fabric of society in the United States that has gotten fallen by the wayside.
Well, so a lot of this stuff is, as we kind of learned in physics or something, tried to... What is it? Every action has a equal and opposite reaction. And everybody, I mean, that, you know, in Evergreen Park, you know, the houses were a little bigger. I mean, where we moved after my junior in high school. But in St. John Fisher, all the houses were small. I mean, you had to interact. When you, as Mike Royko said about child discipline, the old man had to smack you upside the head because there was no place to put you in a timeout. Every place was full. There was no spot. They couldn't stick you in a room by yourself because the room was being used, you know, type of thing. You know, you were forced to interact. There was, and now you read these stories of, you know, mostly white guys, and sitting in their basements, their parents' basement, no job. The parents never see them. They never come out, and they're on. They're on, you know, God knows what part on the web, just talking hate stuff to people all day long. Logistically, you could never have done that in our day. How could you?
Well, you couldn't, and part of it's, you know, we have technology that allows it to. So, that becomes a part of it. And, you know, there's even a lot of people who are online gamers. And so they're interacting with a lot of people online. So you're isolated and alone together, which is a strange phenomenon. But it is part of the fabric of what's going on with a lot of people.
Well, one of the one of my buddies is an attorney. He's been on the show a couple times. He told me, my son's meeting his like best friend today, and I go, what? I mean, meeting his best friend? Well, he's meeting his best friend. And I go, how do you just meet your best friend? Well, he's going back and forth gaming with this guy in Florida for like 8 years. They talk all the time. I never met. I go, there's nothing wrong with that, Kevin. It just seems...
But it's different.
It's different.
Not, it's not part of your experience or my experience.
Yeah, it's... anyway, what do you... We've had a string of... And this is what obviously concerns me about the market, as you well know, in the sense that the market is... Well, it's not really... It looks like it's too complacent. But it's really not, because it's just dancing to the tune of what's going on monetarily in the country for the last 25 years. And now, instead of getting better, it's probably going to get worse, because Trump administration wants to go back. But it's not like it hasn't been bad since 2000. I mean, it's been bad. I mean, when I say bad, we've poured too much money in the system. I know I say this every day, but they don't stop. And what happens is, over a period of time, the dollar is devaluated in value, and people and things with assets have gone up. Anybody who thinks the market up 40% is the money supply has gone up 40%, that it's your genius investing, well, I'm sorry. It was genius to be in and not out. That part I get. But the idea that you picked the right stock, well, guess what? They're pretty much all up, even though some are up more than others. So now the question is that going to end? And these are very serious decisions for me, because I manage people's money. And I have been blessed in the last 6 months, because I was early, and I will always admit it. I thought that if they're going to keep doing this with the dollar, for a long time I fought it, thinking we're not going to do this. We're not going to do, you know, the late 70s, early 80s again. We're too smart for that. Well, then finally I figured out we're not too smart for that, and I just got to, and now I just got to go with it. So since then, instead of writing covered calls on stuff, which is part of my strategy, and getting them jammed basically up my ass every single time, I'm saying, wait a minute, let's not do that. Even though that's what you, quote, should be doing to pay for the put protection. So, but I'm saying we can't do that. All we're doing is getting jammed, and we're not participating. And because I think these idiots, instead of, like, for 10 years I thought, Kevin, they were going to see the light and realize this is not what you want to do. It finally dawned on me it's exactly what they wanted to do, and they were going to keep doing it. It took me a while, because it takes me a while to not like what people are doing and thinking they're whatever. I think that, you know, in the last 25 years, someday is going to write history. You're going to find the biggest crooks that ever lived were running our government, collectively. They did it all for themselves and for big people. But whatever. But now, at least I've figured it out. So I go, all right, what's lagging here? Gold and silver are lagging. I don't know why they're not. People are going to crypto or something instead. They become the new gold, whatever it is. And I'm thinking, this is not going to last if they keep doing this. So I got people involved in the gold miners and silver 2-3 years ago. And it sputtered and sputtered and sputtered. And all of a sudden this year, every day it's going up. Every day. It's more than doubled this year. After an obvious play for 2 years, didn't go anywhere, and all of a sudden it's more than doubled. You know, everybody thinks, you know, I'm a genius. Well, if I was a genius, I'd have waited till this year to get in it, right? I was early. But now I look at this. The GDX, which is the Gold Miners Index, started the year at like 33. Now it's 77. It's only friggin' in September. Well, I guess we're October 1st today. And I'm looking at it, Kevin, and I go, okay, I surely don't like it as much at 77 as I did at 32, duh. But I'm going, in my first instinct, my trader instinct, is I got to get out of it here. What am I doing with this? We're still long this thing, up 40-some bucks on the year. Then I look at the policy of the administration. I see how egregious the Fed has been, and the abuse they're getting for not being more egregious. And as he keeps replacing people after people in there, we're talking about going from a 7% money supply growth to probably a 12%. And one of these days, it's going to show up in the CPI, if they stop lying, where people, finally, somebody writes an article somewhere that says, don't believe the damn thing. Somebody has more carry than me, I guess. But now I'm sitting there going, I'm wondering if this thing is just starting at 77. That we could see $5,000 gold, which is incredibly stupid. We should never see $5,000 gold. But I have a feeling it might. I can't believe it, but I'm sitting there going, I just got to keep my hands in the boat and let these guys make their mistakes and just ride it. I can't fight what they're doing, because they're doing it. And if they're doing it, the market's going higher, unless the only fly in the ointment is one day you're going to see the 30-year rate. They're going to go to an auction and they're going to back and it's going to be up 1.5% or 2%, and everybody's going to say, what the bleep? But until that day, I don't. They want to do more, Kevin. This is not, I mean, I, you know, look, I just did some work here in, from 2000 to 2008, which was, who was that? Was that Bush? That was Bush. Money supply grew by 8.3% a year. And we didn't do, we had like hardly any growth in there, did we? So I'm going to say our growth was 2%. The actual inflation for that period of time was probably 6. And they told us it was what, less than 2? Because it's all, you know, most of it was in the medical community, and they just don't count that for some reason. From 2008 to today, which includes who the hell's in there? It's Obama, Trump, Biden, and Trump again, right? We've averaged 11%. What do you think our growth has been? 1, 2, 3, maybe 3.
Real growth?
Yeah. So we're talking, again, almost a 7 or 8% inflation every year. That the population's not growing by 11% a year. I mean, what? And you look at yourself. Why are these houses 400,000 when in 2000 they were 135 or something? 150. Duh! It's not because you were a genius and bought the house. It's because the value of the dollar is down. If you put $1 million in the bank in 2000, what have you averaged in the bank? Maybe 1.5-2% for 25 years. So it means you're up to what? 1.4 million, maybe 1.3 million. I don't know what 2% for 25 years is. And I'm going to say that it's worth way less than when you put it in there, way less. Is that what you want to do to people? But so many people benefit by it. You don't like the German things, but the people that did that was the Weimar Republic. And it was before Hitler. Weimar Republic probably gave us Hitler, that and the Treaty of Versailles. But those guys had a reason to do that. And, now the reason is we want to make rich people richer. But their reason actually was they declared it, I don't know if you know this or not, Kevin, they declared that a huge success. The reason why is they were, the Weimar was, because of the Treaty of Versailles, which could have been, could there any document have done more damage in this world than the Treaty of Versailles?
I'll take your word on it.
Something like 95...
That never would get me into trouble.
95%... of all the known oil reserves were on one side of the table when they left. That's a problem, right? It was talk about a circle bleep. The people in Germany had to pay reparations because of the treaty to France and England. Okay, and so France and England had to pay World War I debt back to us. And meanwhile, we were letting the Germans sell allegedly gold-backed bearer bonds in the U.S. Because I did some work on this for somebody. People here are buying these bonds. The money's going back to Germany, to go back to Britain and France, to go back to our government. And I'm reading this stuff, Kevin. You wonder where I get my cynical mind. What possesses me to read this crap like this? I have no idea. I'm sitting there going, so these guys pour money into the system. So what happens? The marks, or whatever the things were, I think they were Deutschmarks, pre-Deutschmark, whatever, they're going to Britain and France, but guess what? They're not worth anything. And the other side of the coin was, if you happen to be a farmer, which, own most of the property, now all of a sudden, the price of wheat has gone from, 50 cents a bushel to 250. So you made nominally, four times as much as you thought you were going to make. Now it's funny money. But your mortgage is written up in like if it's real money. So first thing you did is went down to the bank and said, here's my cash, I don't have a mortgage anymore. So people who owe dough are big winners on this. And you say, I shouldn't give a shots like this. Well, okay, we have somebody in the office, mobile office, that owns places he owns dough on. It's going to work fine for him and people like that. But I think Kevin, the long-term effects of it is the Weimar Republic said it was a success because Britain and France said, wait a minute, we will renegotiate. And the people, I'm going to bet most of your big farms in Germany are still owned by the people who paid the thing off during the 20s. So it's not like if all this goes away, the guys with money now are still going to own the baseball teams, the football teams. They're still going to own, I don't know about Mar-a-Lago because that was bought from the government. They're still going to own the Doral. They're going to own all that stuff. And somebody's going to wonder, how the hell did they get all this stuff? This is how they got it. Because
in the most benign interpretation of it, are you surprised that the guy in charge of economic policy or the guy driving economic policy is doing it through the lens of a real estate developer?
No,
if we're not being cynical, which I'm all in favor of a healthy dose of cynicism, but to filter through that and just say, you know, that, you know, that's the view of the economy is through somebody who has spent his life in real estate development, and that's not the same world that where the rest of us live. It's, you know, it really is, and I remember this from my Chicago banking days, is how, you know, how real estate developers work and what they do, and so on, and it's just a hugely different perspective compared to what a manufacturer might look at, for example.
Well, but I think if and as this is, and we have people on the show. I mean, when Hal goes off on one of his rants about economics, I mean, I hope other people
Hal doesn't really rant.
No, I'm saying when he wanders off to where I don't think many people can really understand what the hell he's talking about, because he gets theoretical. At the end of the day,
he definitely is theoretical.
That's
actually a really good addition to the show, I think.
I've had people who, you know, a lot of, shall we say, older women that listen to the show, and they say, "I don't understand a word you said yesterday." And I said, "Well, you want me to dumb it down?" And they say, "Don't ever dumb it down, or I'll stop listening." It's up to me to ask a question, ask you to write you a letter, or to go find out. An interesting perspective, isn't it?
It's a good perspective, a healthy, very healthy perspective.
Yeah.
We talk about things that are missing in our society. That's one of them.
But I would say this, Kevin, and I probably could do this if you gave me some time. It's been a long time. I would say that if I were to ask you a question, now you, of course, would go learn this stuff and write the 8 paper, because it's just the way you are. If I were to say to a class, or what did Dinklo used to say? Students? There was a tax guy at Notre Dame. He's a character. Big, huge man. He played tackle or someplace. The guy's shoulders couldn't barely get in the door. Students? He had this high-pitched voice, too, for such a huge man. If I were to say to you, or give you this exam, suppose in a society, over a 20-year period, the owners of buildings did 10 times better than the renters. Would that be a sign of a healthy economy or not? If not, why not?
If you were to ask me, I would say no. We want everybody to thrive. If you start leaving people behind, that's not a good thing.
Well, I mean, what it says to me, because I'm a monetarist, I could pinpoint it right away. Too much money in the system. Because in theory, everybody, and this happened to me in an egregious reason. The CBOE, you could either buy a seat or rent a seat, okay? But if you rented a seat, you could obviously put people to work and so forth, and nobody really looked at the investment value of a seat, like going forward, other than the fact that you could trade with it. So I had 10, you know, I had some money at the time. I had 10 traders working for me, and they were all leased seats. We might own one. And, looking back on it, if I'd have seen the way the world was going to be and turn out, I wouldn't have anybody working for me. I would have bought 3 seats that now are worth a fortune. Nobody trades anymore. So the trading part of that is no good. They just become an exchange or charge people for quotes and charge people to do business. So it's the capital nature of it. But if somebody has a business, if Kevin O'Neill has a business where you're making 8 or 10%, pick a business, your construction business, a restaurant or something, the last thing you want to do is put your capital in an apartment building. You want to rent, don't you? Because the apartment building should be returning somebody.
Because you would rather divert your funding, your capital to your business. And there should be, I was going to say it doesn't have to be neutral, but essentially renting versus buying should be more or less neutral depending on your personal circumstances.
Right.
And to say that, you know, personal circumstances could just as well be that I want mobility in my life. And so if I want to be able to move for a new job, for example, and that I'm in a business where that happens a lot, then I don't really want to be stuck with a house and a mortgage that I have to unload. Now, there was a time when you could just do that. That was no problem. You put yourself on the market, and 30 days later you're out and you're buying a new house in your new place, and you know you're only going to be there a year or two, but that's okay because I keep building equity. That isn't the world anymore. necessarily. Now, you may build equity because of inflation rates and housing prices, but that's a bubble that we saw what happens when that bubble bursts in 2008, 9, and into 10. There were jobs available in the oil industry, for example, where people would have to move, but they had this anchor. And so, but the house was underwater, so they were just walking away from it. And that put the financial industry in a trick bag because they had all kinds of non-earning assets on their books. It needs to be a decision that people make that is based on their personal circumstances, not one of those duh things like you're supposed to own a house, you've got to build equity. And so when we skew it one way or the other, I think we're not doing people a service.
There were people in New York that I met mostly through Rabin, older New York, mostly all Jewish people, but that doesn't matter. They all had beautiful apartments. There were no condos in those days. I think there might have been a few co-ops, but condo was when the condos started, early 70s.
Yeah, I would say it's a 70s phenomenon is when they really started.
They lived in the same apartment for 35 years. They never felt they were getting jobbed. The people who made money on the six flats and so forth and had an outsized return. I'll use this term. I'll try and explain this. Is that most of the people, especially the Southside people, working class, don't know how can I put this nicely, where I'm congratulating them and saying they're dumb. They don't know how to count. So if you had an apartment building that you ran, and ran, when I say legitimately, I'm talking about accounting-wise, legitimately, and you should make, if the risk-free rate is 3%, you should probably make 6.5% or 7%. It's a pretty stable business. I mean, it used to be anyway. A pretty stable business. You should do more than the risk-free rate, blah, blah, blah. But you're going to have people that, well, I make 10%. My rent's $100,000 and my expenses are $90,000. And I'm going to say that's bullshit. Because virtually every one of those guys, and me, I would do the same thing, and so would you. Guess what? Somebody wrecks a sink, they fix the sink. They shovel the snow. They cut the grass. If a deck needs redoing, they get their brother-in-law over and they redo the deck. They don't count that. Okay, so they really, their own labor is not counted. So they're taking a 4% hit if they would have hired somebody. So the 10 or 15% they think they're making is really 8% plus they're acting as the carpenter for the other 7. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you hired somebody to do everything, which a business would do, you probably drop back down to that 6, 7, or 8%, which is I'll use the term legit. When I say legit, because if it was 20, everybody in the world would be buying a place, right? I'm saying you always come back to equilibrium. That's why that's why patents are such an outlier. Because if Kevin O'Neill comes up with a new drug or a hula hoop or whatever it is, some unusual idea, he gets it to market quick. He gets a 6-month to 3-year advantage before somebody catches up, and his return to entrepreneurship is the other people trying to catch up. Correct. Now, if you throw a patent in there, well, they don't have to catch. They can't catch up for 17 years, which is a problem, which turned out to be a problem. Could you think of anything, Kevin, that theoretically versus actually has worked out more screwed up than patents? I mean, in theory.
I can't, and I think it is the 17 years. And maybe that made sense once upon a time when we had longer lead times to develop things. But now in a computerized age, the lead time to develop is so much shorter. The ability to model things and to so on. So in that regard, if a patent should be 5 years. Maybe we like the idea of patents, but we just don't like the term. And I think that's a huge factor in the economy that needs to be fixed.
Of course, we got 12 minutes. We can solve all the problems in the world here. I was jousting with Carl a little bit. By the way, we have Dr. Demiak today because I think Russell's on end of road. whenever I get jousting with Carl, it's always kind of a joust because we could there be a harder guy in the world to agree with than Carl? but the part that Carl and I are always at odds
not
about
me really, but
you could be the same way. The I don't somehow or another everybody launches back to their political gripes and their gripes about people, and I keep bringing up. I'm always one of these guys, Kevin. I don't know why. Some education somewhere. I can't even. I always think that you got to solve stuff from the bottom up and not from the top down, because otherwise you just don't. You don't get there. Maybe it's because I tried to do zero. What was the budgeting? Zero based budgeting. Mm-hmm. I learned about that in grad school. So in two or three different places that I worked, I became the zero based budgeting guy, and I knew it would never work, and it never did. Because it comes from the top down, and it doesn't work that way. I mean, whenever we talk about drug prices, and I'm the guy who picks a drug. I just happened to pick Eliquis because one of my friends went through the math on it for me a few months ago, and I couldn't believe it. And I know a lot of old people have to be on Eliquis, right? It's not a blood thinner; it's an anticoagulant, right? Anyway, so and then you know, Carl will always launch off into. These guys are all crooks. You know, you got to throw them all in jail. They're breaking this law, that law, and the other. And by the way, he's right. But nobody cares about laws anymore, Kevin. To say somebody's breaking the law, it's like me saying the guy shouldn't go through the red light on a bike. It's like peeing into Lake Michigan. What am I going to do with that comet? Not one ever stops for a stop sign. And one day somebody gets hit. It's all about the brutal car drivers, right? Anyway, but what I'm saying is somehow, some way. A few of us, or a few of people that are in office or someplace, they got to sit down and say, okay, let's take one drug or two drugs. I mean, Viagra was a perfect example, but people think, you know, it's a drug you don't need, it's a drug you want, or whatever. How is it, all right, we get this drug, it goes through some sort of, you know, whatever, testing period, okay, the FDA is all, whatever. They go through something, and they get, quote, approved. And they get this, and they have this patent. All right, now, I would say, now, if I was doing this blackboard at Camp David, hopefully I'd get people from both sides of the aisle there, and they wouldn't all be throwing shit at each other. I'd get on the blackboard and say, okay, number one, the patent. How are we sure that the people we gave the patent to are the people that are actually responsible for the drug? Now, that would be a six-week conversation, even at Camp David, right? Because what we've learned from Katie and a couple other people around the show, there's all kinds of people that donate money to universities. There's people that work there. They have to sign off that whatever they do is belongs to them. Then maybe the university doesn't even do it. They sell it to somebody else. Who the hell is the somebody else? So that would be number one. How do we even sure that... But now we sit there and go, okay, what about the patent? It's 17 years. Now, is that too long? I think you would think, and I would agree, it's probably too long. All right, well, let's make it five. All right, so now if it's five... And all of a sudden, everybody this is a drug that everybody needs, and well, not everybody, but enough people do. Do you have the right to charge whatever you goddamn please, even if maybe you didn't do all the work on it in the first place, and it comes out and you say, well, it cost me $1.50 a shot, and I'm charging $5,000 a shot because hey, let me tell you, we need money for all this research. Wait a minute, did you even do the research in the first place? I mean, just in this little conversation, how many questions have popped up that have nothing to do with throwing people in jail and laws and everything? How exactly would we fix it, Kevin? I don't know. I mean, but there's got to be a message there somewhere.
Well, yeah, and when you get regulatory protection, then I'm a little less concerned about regulatory constraints, too. So that all of a sudden that comes into play, and so a patent is a regulatory protection. So now if we can say, yeah, I'll give you the protection, but you'll damn well here's how you're going to control the prices for consumers. You want the government's largesse, you have to do the government's bidding. So I don't necessarily have a problem with that. It's just not free market stuff, and that's always a problem.
Well, that's been a lot of times, and I think when I talk to Al, he's such a free market guy. The weird part is, there might only be one person in the world that's more of a free market guy than he is, and that's me. He didn't trade 20 years in the trading floor. Can't be more free market than that. But here's the thing. I think every time, who was the you're supposed to know this. Who's the Eastern guy that said no man can do just one thing? It wasn't the guy.
Some Eastern guy.
Who's the guy who wasn't the guy who wrote the book on war, Art of War? Who was that?
Oh, that was Sun Tzu.
Yeah, well, I don't think it was him. But anyway, I mean, so say for instance, and you know, it's funny if you made everybody. You shouldn't do that to anybody, but you suggested to everybody, if I could compile a book on the business history of railroads in the first 50 years, it should be required reading for everybody in business and in business law. Because every single dirty trick, it was like a fetish. You can't invent a new one. Every dirty trick was tried by people, and people don't change. And every governmental thing you're just talking about, you give somebody something, you got to take something away. Because people were given all this land to build the railroad. The idea being you could sell off the land for the money to build it. So, okay, you were essentially given this monopoly, at least for a while, because there were no roads for another 100 years. You were given a monopoly. So now, if Kevin brings his corn to the railhead and he goes, gee, can you guys ship my corn to Chicago? Yeah. How much you want? How much you got? You know, all of a sudden they said, wait a minute, this can't happen. Because there's no road near the place, you can't charge $1 a mile per bushel. When somebody going where there is some competition, they're charging 1 cent a mile. So we're gonna have this ICC, this huge regulatory structure, to at least make this stuff even. Now, do I want a regulatory structure like that? No. But since you just gave away four monopolies going west, you got to do something. I mean, what's the something? I don't know. But it's certainly not free market anymore, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think that, you know, this is the thing that, you know, and this was where Hal would just, chime right in and say, yeah, we're undermining the free market. This becomes the theoretical. But it's also, you know, as a practical matter. So let's go back to patents. I understand why people want patent protection. It's for, you know, so it's so that I can innovate, and I can innovate, and it takes so long for me to bring things to market. And in many cases, that bringing things to market involves getting regulatory approval, which can drag on for years. So if the government's going to drag out for years my ability to get my invention to market, then I should have some time for protection. Okay, cool, I get that. But then, yeah, it becomes exactly what we were just discussing, and that is, okay, what are they, you know, in exchange for that protection, what becomes your requirement? And that's the side of the equation that we don't handle. And that's a problem.
Have you actually, I've come across, and we don't do this at PTI, we don't raise money for people, but of course people always call me, once in a while, will call me and say, gee, you know, I got a buddy who's trying to raise some capital, how about go and talk to him? And I would do that, but that's not our business. I mean, it's a totally different business. I've known two people, Kevin, that actually had a device. Both of them happen to be scientific instruments, one medical, one not, that really worked, and they had a small niche market, and were doing very well, and actually could have expanded and blah, 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 and could use it. Every time it was a family falling apart, and two of the people wanted to sell, and one of the other person wanted to keep it going as their business and needed some money to buy essentially the family members out. Anyway, long story to need to tell that, I suppose. But in both cases, I said, God, did you guys patent this? They looked at me like I had 15 heads, Kevin. Why would we ever do that? All you do is put your product into the patent office, and 15 assholes are gonna come out and say they have a patent like that because they bought 100 zillion patents from somebody else, and this one matches up. So you never want to do that. So how do you contrast that with, gee, if I do something unique, I should get protection for a while, which everybody believes, and that you and I could probably go through a list of 15 patents that everybody knows about that the guy didn't even invent in the first place. I mean, you know, like the telephone.
Yeah, patent winds up getting bought instead.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So that's a problem that's part of it, and I'm not sure, you know, that there aren't a lot of things that really don't deserve patent protection at all, even though you do have the claim that you invented it. That sometimes, you know, you just bring products to market And there is some value to being first to market. There is sometimes being first to market is not the best thing. And it just depends on the product. I'm really thinking that patent protection, if it were to apply to anybody, is that it should be people who have all kinds of roadblocks to getting something to the market. And so by the time you have your invention, it's you're 5 to 10 years down the road. And if you're 5 to 10 years down the road on something before you can get it to market, that patent protection becomes a big deal.
Yeah, you remember.
But a lot of that is regulatory, and some of it isn't. Some of it has to do with just how long the development cycle is, and so you don't want everybody else to get a whiff of what you're doing and saying, okay, they're halfway down the road. I can steal a few of their people and get myself halfway down the road starting today.
Kevin, you remember guy? He played ball for a while. Dave Azzarello, blonde haired guy.
Sure. Yeah, I remember Az.
Well, Az was telling me one night about his. Remember the old cars? He had the big dome light in the middle, and then we opened the door. And he was telling me something about his mother's brother. Anyway, whoever, some guy. Of course, he didn't talk to Az's family. He goes, "Yeah, that's my uncle. That's like his patent." And I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Look at the thing." And it was in the middle of if you ever find yourself in like a 65 Oldsmobile, open a door and look up in the middle at the dome light. It's kind of a ridged plastic, where they used to have just a piece of glass, right? It was this ridged plastic. So this guy invented the fact that with the ridges, evidently it cast more light in different directions with a less voltage bulb than they had used before. And he got a patent on it. And if you look real close, there was a patent number on this plastic thing that went on the dome light. Well, that was his uncle's patent, and I think the guy got like a quarter or 30 cents for every one of those that went in every car for like a decade. but he actually did it, and it was cheap enough where nobody wanted to. It was clearly his, and General Motors just said, "All right, we'll give you let us make it, and we'll give you a quarter for every one we make." And he goes, "Okay." So, I mean, I guess in his case it sort of worked, but it's kind of rare, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it did work for him, but that's, that's the kind of thing where I say, okay, is that really, deep intellectual product that needs protection, or, did he just come up with something that that was saleable and, just do it?
Yeah, I mean, but there's this stuff about, what was the thing with the EpiPen, where it was developed by the Army, according to Lou. What they call the EpiPens? If you have a bee stings you stick it through your pants and it goes right in and you give yourself a shot.
Have a severe, an anaphylactic type of reaction to any allergen, people have it with shellfish? Peanut oil would be a real common one where someone eats something they didn't realize that there was peanut oil or was cooked in peanut oil, whatever. And you can just stab through the. Through the clothing and deliver the drug.
Well, my doctor tells me
basically.
Well, the Army invented it, right? And my doctor tells me, she goes, if somebody's in my office and I have to give them a shot for that, the antidote, whatever the hell the drug is, she goes, it costs me $1.50. Now, somebody went out at the same time, it was the Department of Education or somebody said that every classroom had to have one of these things in there. At the same time, who was the, not that I noticed, a very attractive lady who I don't think she ended up going to jail, but the place went, she had all these people on the board, but they got a patent.
Yeah, you're talking about Heather Bresch was the Manchin's daughter.
Yeah, but they ended up getting a patent for a new cap on the thing. And so it was like $600, and all the schools were buying them and stuff. But the patent wasn't on the poking it through your pants, and it wasn't on the drug inside, it was on the cap or something was on that pen or whatever that thing was, and they had nothing to do with the functioning of it, but then they raised the price
it did was extend the patent protection for the product.
But there wasn't any, because it was because the drug wasn't patented, and neither was the mechanism. She did something for the the cap was different or something weird like that. It had nothing to do with the functioning of it. It was so bizarre, and she gets a patent on this thing and markets it, and everybody's paying $600 for his pen without even asking, by the way, who invented it? How much does the stuff inside cost? How bizarre was that? But the government was buying the damn things.
So that, you know, this sort of makes our point here, is that the patent protection is, not economic. And it's going to inflate the price of a product that doesn't need to be inflated.
Well, how do you go from...
It shouldn't have been
inflated. I'm not accusing you of pounding these things into yourself. How did Viagra go from 17 years... How'd they get the extra 2 years? What was the legal reason for that? They somehow made some kind of claim that something changed in the meantime, and they got an extra... How do you get 19 years?
Yeah, I don't know. I know there's... I keep seeing these ads now where you can get it for, like, less than a buck a pill.
Yeah, well, they were charging 50. That's a number.
Yeah.
And they will tell you it all in the research.
Isn't it?
I still... The only thing about those things, I do miss the commercials. Just saying. Because the day that those guys, and was it Cialis was the other one? They came off patent roughly in like a 6-month period of time. And I think they were, Kevin, were they $20 or $40 million to the NFL? They were all over CNBC. They had to be their biggest advertiser. I can't believe they weren't on Stocks and Jocks. we could have used $20 million, you think?
given our age group demographic?
Oh, our demographics have been all over the thing. The only thing I remember is if the ladies in those commercials actually were in their 50s and 60s. Have you ever seen a better looking group? For God's sake. The commercials were fun to watch just because of the women in the luggage, for God's sake. Who cares about the guy? Just saying. How does that sound like a grumpy old south side guy?
It's not necessarily going to be everybody's point of view. There's going to be people that are looking and, you know, they don't care about the women.
I guess. All right, who do you like?
I still care about the drug.
We have Friday to talk about the football. Boy, is what's his name ever going to play again? The guy that hurt his leg the other night? Tyreek Hill? I refuse to watch it. I saw it when it happened.
Yeah, I know it was a really nasty one. I haven't seen what it looked like, but you never know. Hey, I don't rule out anything with an athlete. When these guys, you know, they're so driven, you know, what it takes to get to the NFL or to the Major League Baseball or the NBA or anything, for most of them, it's not all raw talent. There's a whole lot of drive and a whole lot of dedication that goes in there. So I would not rule out any of them as people who might find their way back, because, you know, once the mind's made up, there's a lot of willpower behind that. So we'll see, we'll see if he's able to, you know, recover enough, because Tyreek Hill's big superpower certainly has been his speed as well as his, you know, his other athletic gifts. So we will see, but I would not rule him out.
Well, sometimes the more gruesome... we have Dr. Demiak in the room?
I agree with Kevin. I really think that a lot of athletes they're so competitively driven. Yes, they like the money. Yes, they like all the fame, but they want to win. That drive to win is overwhelming. And to your point, a lot of them will follow through and do whatever it takes so that they can show up and participate.
Well, you also, just because, you know, to us, I'm certainly no doctor, just because an injury looks egregious doesn't really mean that it's that much worse than one you think isn't egregious.
Sure.
I mean, you can have a leg break where the bone's sticking out, but if it's, which is probably way better than if you have two or three breaks that stay inside, right? In terms of healing.
And I keep thinking back to when Michael Jordan played with food poisoning. Right.
Yeah.
Even with the food poisoning, and we can debate if it was intentional or not intentional food poisoning, but he showed up to the game and fought through it because he was going to get paid either way. But that competitive drive to show up and to win is overwhelming for these professional athletes.
It is. And also the what was it? The the thrill of competition and the agony of defeat. Remember that from Wide World? Athletics, and Kevin, you know, played a real lot of ball too. You never know. When Kevin and I were talking about the guy on the Cubs, what the hell? The guy's hitting 162. He can't find his ass with both hands. All of a sudden, the guy's got home run, 6 days in a row, and he's their star again. I mean, you never. Athletics is so bizarre. I mean, and if you never played, you don't necessarily know that, because I'll give you a real quick Cliff Notes story. I'm playing a softball team in Oak Lawn, and I was halfway decent. I mean, I was. Where would you put me, Kevin? On a scale of 1 to 10, I was a 6.5, maybe. You know, not much better. Maybe a little above average, but and all of a sudden,
I don't know. I'm not commenting, Tom.
I wasn't a 10. I know that, but I was better than a 1. So somewhere in the middle. So, doctor, all of a sudden, I everybody says they never get sick. Well, somehow I caught something from the trading pit, and I've got this 102 fever in July. I'm going, what the hell? I can't even move. And these guys call me and they go, hey, we don't have another pitcher. You got to get out here. So it's 90 degrees. I'm wearing a sweatshirt. I get out there, no warm-ups, no nothing. I go to the mound, and I'm going, look, all I'm going to do is pitch strikes. I pour the thing over. They're hitting the ball right at people. I come to bat. I swung at the first pitch every time. All I wanted to do was hit the center of the ball. I didn't care anything. I get 4 hits. It was one of the best pitching games I've ever had. All of a sudden, next week, I'm feeling fine. Warm up, hitting the ball, hitting the snot out of the ball. Every time I touched it, I hit it right at somebody, and I think I pitched like crap. you never know. I mean, it's just that's the beauty of, or that's the vagaries of sport, Kevin. Am I right or wrong?
There's a randomness factor that comes into play there too. But on the competitive stuff, it's also why, you know, you will find you'll find a lot of athletes who are jerks. Of course, I guess we find any walk of life, you'll find people who are jerks. But you know, they are so competitive. That means you got to win every argument. That means you have to, you know, everything that goes that could possibly go into your daily life becomes a competition as well. And some people can tune it, you know, can turn it down for real life and just put it on the field. I was like that. You know, I could you put me on the field, I'd be the biggest jerk going. And then, you know, as soon as the game's over, I go back to being me, nice guy me. Everybody agree. Yes.
Yeah. We're thinking
for that one. but man, I'm telling you, once I walked on a field or onto a court or onto the ice, if it came into my head, it came out of my mouth.
Doctor, since you brought it up, let's stay on the subject just a hair, if you don't mind. I mean, Kevin's always liked being on this. I used to go to spring training every year, and back in the day, I'd run out and I'd do my running in the fields because you could do that. And I'd go over to Cubs had their, they were at Hohokam Park, was where they played. Now they got a different place. But the minor league camp was right down the block. So I'd walk over there after I worked out, back when I used to do those things. I'd sit there and watch. And, doctor, you would sit there with a notebook. You'd be taking this in like a sponge. What's going on with all the people? First of all, there's like 30 people on the field all working out at the same time. Have you ever seen guys work out in baseball? They got screens up to protect the guys, like at third base, but then they're hitting balls at a shortstop, hitting outfield balls. The guys taking bad. It's the choreography is unbelievable, and you'll see, you know, all these 15 guys standing in the outfield, and all of a sudden, you know, Kevin comes up, they turn around and walk back 10 feet. All of a sudden, the ball sounds a little different coming off the bat, and everybody's dragging them in on the warning track instead of 20 feet up, and you can see there are people that have the gene pool, just looks different, right? But by the same token, not everybody's like that. And you'll see people every day. You see people walking in with bags and walking out with bags. And you look at them, and they all kind of look the same. And I think to your point and Kevin's, you're always, Babe Ruth is always going to stand out. You know, Ernie Banks, somebody asked one day, when he came into camp, did you notice him? I guess, you know, first he was black. Guy goes, well, let's see, he had the best arm on the team, he was the best hitter, and he's the fastest guy. Yeah, we noticed him. how do you not notice him, even if he wasn't black? And but then the next layer, the 70% guys, the I'll use the term the role players, especially like in basketball, are you really you're way above the gene pool than I would be, but is there a difference really between the guy on the edge of the bench, walking out and walking in, other than really desire, is what you brought up. And willing to just hang. Go ahead.
I don't know that for sure because I have not delved that deep into that. But I remember when I was teaching, particularly in the MSF program, there were a couple of guys that
What's the MSF program?
Master of Science and Finance program.
Okay.
We had a couple of guys that were just brilliant. And then we had a couple of other guys who weren't necessarily as brilliant, but boy, they worked hard. And every time my colleagues and I would talk about the different students, we would always say, we want that guy that really is working hard and wants to be here and is doing the things that he needs to do, or she needs to do, to really make it happen. And I do think, and those guys were successful. Yes, I think that it's really important to be good, but I also think that desire and that person who puts in the extra work and that hard work and those repetitions so that your body is trained to be able to respond, like you're creating those reflexes, right? And whether it be on the sports field or on the trading floor, you want to be able to have that quick response, and you do that by training. And the guys that aren't necessarily training as hard aren't really developing those quick reflexes.
Well, some guys really, I mean, when Ryan Sandberg, Kevin remembers this, Sean Dunstan, after the game, Ryan Sandberg's, he already had a golden glove and he's out taking grounders after the game. And Sean Dunstan says something like, what's he doing taking grounders for? He knows how to take grounders. The guy looks at him and goes, well, why do you think he knows how to take grounders?
Right.
I mean, some guys, I think, can kill themselves by just keep doing it over. I mean, there's a limit to how much you can do. I mean, you can't – even sprinters only run how many sprints per day is training. I mean, you don't run 100. But, can I shift gears here? Kevin and I were talking about – I don't know if you were listening. I hope you were. We're talking about, you know, the patent laws and some of the prices and medical stuff and things. And the idea that, you know, we have people saying these are actual laws that are being violated, and, you know, when are we going to get somebody in office that, instead of being bought off, because they all seem like they are, bought off by these places, are actually going to recognize that these are criminal acts. I mean, setting prices and things like that, and throw people in jail. And Kevin and I were talking about, if you worked it from the way up, I mean, how would you change patent laws? How would you do those kinds of things, or do they need to be changed? And the thought that crossed my mind, Doctor, now you did this, even though you don't know you did this, by being a, you know, high-end university professor. But now we have how many on the show now that you've come on? In the early 1970s, I don't know if this is before your time, but early 1970s, there was all these, you know, monopolies. Regulated was airlines, regulated was trucking, railroads, everybody had these, you know, ICC was still around. There was an amazing push between academia and Congress that this doesn't have to be that way. I mean, a lot of your papers that were written about, hey, you know, you don't need, I don't know if you don't have a, well, I'll say it for everybody else, I'm sure you know. In those days, you couldn't hire a guy to take a package or a load of stuff from your place to a place in Wisconsin, unless they had interstate paper from Illinois to Wisconsin. They couldn't do it. It was illegal. I mean, I worked for Illinois California Express. When I say work for them, I was a dock guy. They had paper between Illinois, Denver, California, and Arizona. They couldn't stop between Illinois and Denver. They had no paper from Illinois to Iowa, no paper from Illinois to Nebraska. So they were known as the Illinois California Express. Duh, because they had to work. They had to be express. Well, there was this, all these people, a lot of them at the University of Chicago, a lot of them at Duke, writing all these papers about how inefficient all this was and how you really needed to deregulate the airlines, get more competition, and how you needed to deregulate the railroads, because there now were enough competitive railroads. And, well, there aren't anymore, but there were then. And with the trucking, you didn't need to do that anymore, and you don't need the ICC. Same thing with, like I said, airlines, railroads, and trucking. And that all, it caught enough, but there was this give and take between universities and some of the people in Congress. I've never seen that before or since, Doctor. I mean, right now the thought, well, right now, you know, I'll take a, we have an administration that's doing nothing but fining universities and telling everybody how they're screwing up. I mean, the thought of those guys listening to a professor, but even if it's not those guys, it's not just them. I've never seen any coordination like that really since the early 70s. Why? What do you think?
Well, one of the things I wanted to comment about the patents, and I think this goes into it, there's a huge component that we're skipping over, and that's the lawyers. So you got to think, every time something like this happens, the lawyers are the ones that are really benefiting, because if there is a issue with a patent, they're the ones who are going to get paid, right? And to your example with the regulation with transportation, all of those lawyers involved in it, so all of those regulations are beneficial to lawyers, and they're more likely to continue those types of systems even if they're inefficient. There's not a lot of motivation for so we've got lawyers, we've got the government, and we've got education, and there's not a lot of motivation to work together. In fact, from a lawyer standpoint, there's a lot of motivation that these two entities don't work together. Because if they don't work together, then they have the opportunity to fight things in court, which then benefits them, the lawyers, that is, directly. So I think once you start to think about these regulations and these laws, you really want to think, who is benefiting from having these laws on record? And most of the times, it's not necessarily the industry, but it's the fact that we do have these laws, so now we have lawyers who can argue them out and get paid quite a bit of money to do it.
And to, again, when we talk about, first of all, now politicians who would change the laws, how many of them are lawyers?
Right.
So that becomes part of the equation. But in addition to that, let's put the most benign interpretation on it, even though this probably not, it may not be true, but that is their lens, as you know, they're products of this system. And so two attorneys who have been practicing, especially if they've been practicing in patent law, this is just a normal, you know, a normal situation, a normal way of life. And they're not necessarily seeing it as something that is bad or anything else. It's just something that is, and it's where they make their living. This is, you know, I've used this the same outlook looking at the NCAA, where, you know, when we talk about sports and some of the things that have over the years have gone on, where the deal has always favored, until recently, has always favored the schools, not the athletes. That nothing, you know, that without diminishing the value of a college education, because it's extremely valuable, but nevertheless, the cost of tuition, room, and board did not in any way reflect the economic value that they brought to so many of the schools. Well, how many people did you have who would talk nothing about the value of of being exposed to the college experience, even if you don't get a degree? They'd have all these kinds of things, and they believe them. They absolutely believe them, even though you a normal person would look at it and go, "You got to be kidding me." I think that that's going to be part of what a lawyer's outlook is going to be on the system is, look, I've been living in this world for a long time. It is my normal world, and I don't think it's bad, because otherwise, if I think it's bad, then I think I'm bad for being a part of it. It's not going to be their outlook on it, and so they're not going to have a financial interest in not changing it, but they also have an emotional investment in not changing it.
Okay, but the question, well, I thought the question on the table, I guess, is what you guys have just said. By the way, it's very articulate as usual. The same thing was there in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. I mean, people had never seen an airline industry that wasn't regulated. To most people, it worked fine. I mean, the same way with trucking. Well, I got my paper. What's the problem? If I want to be able to go to Ohio, I buy a license to go to Ohio. I mean, the three of us easily could have said this isn't very efficient. But the lawyers in that time, wait a minute, you're gonna take away my paper? I just paid for it, for God's sake. It's like putting Uber in a city when everybody else just paid for a cab medallion. But I guess my question was, what was so unique about the 71 through 74 era? By the way, I would also include the CBOE in there, the Chicago Board Options Exchange. Wait a minute, you're not going to have specialists? There's been specialists in the New York Stock Exchange for 100 years. You're going to actually have competing people on the floor? You have an idea? That was an absolute fart in church to the SEC and to the financial community. Yet what I'm saying is, somehow or another, maybe because I was there, and somehow or another, for a 2 or 3 year period, there became this marriage, shall we say, between academia and some people in Congress that basically defeated the status quo. And I've never seen it before or since. And I guess, is it possible for that could happen again someday? I don't know. I don't think so. I guess my question really is, what was so unique about that time that it actually did happen once? That's a hard question.
I can't say anything about that time because that's...
You're too young.
You're too young for that.
You're being nice and saying I'm not old like you guys.
But I will comment, you know, from a faculty member standpoint, we're not necessarily promoted. You know, our job positions here, we're not going to be evaluated on those things. We're going to be evaluated on scholarly work. We're going to be evaluated on peer evaluations and service. And scholarly work is morphed substantially in the last 30 years. So we're now very much competing for top level journals, and that's what secures our job in the academic world, which is one of the reasons why some of the papers in the publishing world is becoming ridiculous. So before, if you look at academic papers, I want to say in the 50s and 60s, you could have a published paper that's only 8 pages long. Now you're looking at papers that are 40 or 50 pages long. Do we necessarily need the additional 32 pages? Perhaps not, but that's this idea of that's how the industry is going, and that's how we justify the quality of some of our research. And again, from an academics perspective, I'm more motivated to do that because that's going to generate job security for me. And very similar to a lawyer, the lawyer's not going to disrupt the system because they're well compensated, right? So our motivations, or a politician doesn't want to disrupt the system because they want to be reelected.
Right.
So understanding the motivations of what was happening and where we are now. So at this moment, there's not a lot of push or even desire to do that type of work because it's not going to generate the recognition that I would need to be promoted at my job.
Yeah, and it's not going to be rewarded the same
it's
way.
Not.
Rewards come elsewhere.
Well, how did a guy, and again, I don't know, this is before my time actually, so it was a long time ago. How did a guy like when the Fed was doing all their stuff during the 60s, late 60s and 70s, and all this inflation started coming in, there were several. The leading guy, I mean, well, maybe because he was from Chicago that I know him, there were several university professors, guys like Milton Friedman, that essentially you knew they were publishing stuff that was picked up in the newspapers. You know, Fed, look yourself in the mirror. You're the problem. You're the reason why there's inflation. It's not dirty Arabs with the oil embargo. It's you. You're putting too much money in because you're trying to pay for the Vietnam War. Everybody knew the other side, and you didn't have him threatened by either, you know, the Democrats not wanting him shutting him up or telling the university. You didn't have a guy like Trump trying to shut him up, and I'm saying Democrats are just as bad. I'm trying politically neutral here this morning, but I mean, the fact is, he was somewhat of a household word, and not only by his voice, but he would publish in papers saying, look, this is the problem. He wasn't alone. There were several other guys. I don't see anybody from academia doing that today. Is it first of all, would they let you? And secondly, would anybody want to do it?
So you wouldn't necessarily want to do it I know Russell and I have been starting to do more of those types of things, but you're not rewarded for it at the university. So you would have to take time away from things that you would be rewarded for to do those types of things.
Okay.
And I also want to make a comment about Milton Friedman. He was special, right? He had an ability to really break down some complex ideas, and his willingness to put out the work, and I don't know how the reward system was done in academia during that time period, but he was truly special in his ability to write and articulate things that people would be able to be compelled and would want to read about the economy.
Yeah, except for one thing. If you had him in class and he started off on something that nobody understood, somebody would ask him, what the hell are you talking about? The answer would be 10 times more complicated than before the question, so you got to the point where nobody ever asked him anything. When you asked him to dumb it down, he ratcheted it up, and you go, what is he doing? But
saying just don't ask questions, look it up later.
Well, plus, I took a course from him, he didn't want to teach. He took, it was something about... It had to do with supply side economics or something, not the Ronald Reagan stuff. It was the theory of price, and he wrote this manuscript and then got so bored with it he stopped. He never published it, so we traded off the manuscript, and you could deflect him off topic real easy because he didn't want. Doctor, he had graphs up there on the board by hand with like 15 calculus things in the same damn chart, and everybody's looking at him, what is he even talking about? There's 15 supply curves on this thing. He was fun to listen to, but boy, talk about a guy who dropped back into calculus in a second. You're right. Not many people could do that. Not many people could understand it. I sure couldn't. I tried, but anyway.
Yeah. So, and I'm going to jump off in a minute, but, just to comment and follow up on some of the things Larissa said, is that, I'm really looking at a different academic experience because I'm teaching at the community college level. So, my experience is less, is not focused in the slightest on publishing. It is really teaching and learning, and it is developing people mostly to go right from, many to go from where we are into a bachelor's degree program at Purdue or IU or even locally at IUSB or Bethel or Goshen College, any of the locals. But so that's a big part of where I'm focused, and what's different about that is it's same thing for course development. I'm finishing off developing a course now for statewide use. It is all about what are we trying to do to prepare people for their careers. Most people are going to go to work, at least in my programs, most people are going to go to work when they complete their curriculum. And so it's a little bit different experience. And this is where, what my students tell me is, hey, Kevin, I can read the book. I can read the book. So I don't want you to come into class and tell me what's in the book. What I want you to come into class and do is tell me what it's like in the real world when I go to work, and that's their big interest. And it also is, as I tell them all the time, I'm going to throw all kinds of other stuff in here, because for instance, in an IT course or a supply chain course, it doesn't matter. I just try to tell them, in your discipline, we're doing this because I'm trying to make you into a better IT professional, or I'm trying to help you be a better supply chain professional. And so it's a little bit different slant, and so we're not wrestling with some of those economic issues in the same way. My job is to get to help them get jobs,
which puts even less pressure or interest for you than to be working with the government to reduce inefficiencies.
Well, I think
exactly. I'm just trying to tell them how to thrive in the workplace. Trying to teach them how to thrive in the workplace, and that's a little bit different slant for me. Although I will tell you that working for Ivy Tech, which is a statewide public school, there seldom goes a week when I don't shake my head and go, "Oh yeah, that's right. You work for the government. No wonder this is all bleeped up."
Well, if we had a newspaper, I suppose there's other places you put it out. I think the world would really benefit by a once a week, maybe 200-word column on economics for the regular person, where we would all take turns, pick a subject and take turns writing it. I think the world would really be beneficial with that. Because I don't think anybody knows any of this stuff now. It just, I mean, very, very few. I mean, I don't even, you talk about the people that I talk to, even the economics of, you know, stadiums. I mean, I don't know anybody can actually add up the numbers. I don't know what people are learning or not. It just seems like the stuff we talk about, it falls on deaf ears a little bit.
You know, I could contribute to that, but right now I'm done contributing.
All right, buddy, you take care of yourself. Doctor, we go for a quick break because we are moving here with this government shutdown. When we come back, maybe we can comment on that a little bit. SP Futures on 28 and NASDAQ Futures on 125. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Ricky on the board. Not Ricky on the board, Andrew's on the board. Ricky was on the board yesterday. Sorry, Andrew. Although Ricky does a nice job too, so you guys both do a nice job. SP Futures down 30 now, and NASDAQ Futures down 135. Again, we've got two things going here. We've got the shutdown last night, which are, you know, a few people think maybe this shutdown might actually make a difference to the market, but maybe not. They haven't. The last 10 don't seem to have. But also, we had a payroll number came out today. Private payrolls were down 32,000 instead of the up 45,000. And we'll talk about with our illustrious professor here in a minute. But I think this economy is on the verge of falling apart. And I hope I'm wrong. Let's put it that way. DAX up 71.3%. FTSE up 58.6. CAC around up 32.4. So a little bit of bullishness over there, but muted bullishness. Nikkei down 381.9%. Hang Seng up 232.8%. Shanghai up 20. Wait a minute. Those guys, for some reason, they're closed today. Andrew, when we're done, right, find out why Hang Seng and Shanghai are closed today, because those numbers did sound familiar like yesterday's. Bonds are actually, 10-year rate is down to 4.11 because of this labor number. They dropped. Oil, 61.97, down 40 cents, so went up to 65. Looking like it was a breakout, and now it's like almost at the lower end of the range. His oil cannot get anywhere. Gold, however, up $33, $39.06. Who would have thunk it? I'm going to try and get a gold prediction out of the doctor when we're done here. Silver up 83 cents, $47.47. I wanted it to stay steady a day. It didn't do that for me. But I hate it when the market doesn't behave just right. Foreign exchange, the Fed is, dollars back pretty far over one. The euro's up over 117 again, 117.5. Dollar's not doing so hot. Same way with the pound, 135.09, back over 135. Crypto up 2,300 bucks, 116.581. We like fake stocks and gold here this morning. What do you have for us, traffic, weather, sports? Cubs win. Cubs win. Andrew, are you there? Seem to have lost Andrew.
Sorry. I got stuck in a bit of a conversation out here. It is 7:38 here in Chicago. Just a little bit of sports news. Well, pretty big news, only a little bit of it. The Cubs won over the Padres for the first playoff game. And today we can look forward to the second one. And that is at 2 p.m. Over to Chicago weather, it's currently 67 degrees. It's going to be persistent dry weather. Will worsen drought conditions throughout the weekend. Whatever that means, we're going to have a high of 73. I don't know if I felt the weather is very dry lately. I felt like it's been pretty normal, if anything. But over in Phoenix, they're currently at 78 degrees. It's going to be sunshine and seasonably warm. They're going to have a high of 99. Finally, for Chicago traffic, nothing out of the ordinary here, but of course traffic is pretty heavy on all the inbound expressways. If you're on the outbound, the only thing to look out for is right around Austin Boulevard. The Eisenhower is building up pretty bad out there. Other than that, it's about business as usual. Back to you, Chief.
Doctor, we have all kinds of topics to discuss. What would be your favorite? Or what all the different questions are brought up for you, what do you want to answer first?
You know, let's talk about the government shutdown.
Yeah, what do you make of that?
You know, I don't know. I think your point was spot on when you said that we've had these threats, we've had shutdowns, and it doesn't seem to impact the overall economy. So I wanted to hear a little bit about your experience with this, because I haven't lived in a time period where it actually did make an impact. I've lived in time periods where we thought it might make an impact, and then the economy just didn't really respond. And it's unfortunate. Well, it's good that the economy isn't really overreacting, but it's one of the topics that I like to discuss in class, and then nothing seems to really happen. So I'm talking like something's going to be exciting, something's moving in the markets, and then something doesn't necessarily change. And I wanted to hear your insight on the longevity.
The nuts and bolts of it is, and I should remember this since you asked me the question. I think they've gone as much as 3-4 weeks. I remember Janet Yellen was treasurer over one of them, and she actually spelled out one day. I mean, she's not one of my favorite people, but she actually spelled out like in 2 weeks who wouldn't get paid, in 4 weeks who wouldn't get paid, and you know we're going to close this, close that. And at the end of the day, though, even though like the parks might be closed for a month, then all the people in the parks end up getting their paychecks. So it's kind of it ends up being somewhat of a paid vacation, which it shouldn't, obviously. But in the military, they're like stage 2 or 3, this is according to her, and I don't know about this time. If it gets to the point where they don't get paid, they don't get to come home. You know, like from Iraq, because they're not getting paid, they just get paid twice the next month or whatever. I mean, it ends up being sort of even, but I think, and I'd love you to correct me on this, I think on one hand, you would say to the people in Congress, okay, come on, you idiots, you voted for these bills, and you voted for the fact that we're borrowing money, and all of a sudden, you know, this gives the opposing party like a second slice at the apple, which most people would say, that's not right. But on the other hand, I think we have an awful lot of, absolute lying going on any one of these bills. When I say that, it started with Ronald Reagan. He was going to save the world with his tax deduction or his tax decrease, which everybody remembers. You know, Saint Dutch. Nobody remembers the year and a half later when Congress was in a panic and how much it was costing them, way more than they thought, and they put through a tax increase. You know, it was the biggest tax increase at the time. Well, now we had, you know, Biden puts through his infrastructure bill under the justification that if we put Wi-Fi in all these neighborhoods, everybody's going to get a job and our tax receipts are going to go through the moon. Okay, well, that was a hunk of crap. And then Trump, you know, cuts taxes in his first term. don't worry. People are going to make so much more money and be so much more investment that our tax receipts are going to increase. Well, that was a load of crap, too. So it seems like, Doctor, to me, that the common occurrence is that people get to this budget deadline and they go, wait a minute, we're not supposed to be this far in the hole. Why are we? And it gives them kind of another slice at the apple because the numbers don't match up to where they thought they were going to be. Now, of course, each side's going to go to a different spot and fight about it, but I think in general that's what people are kind of seeing. I mean, if you look at people's projection 2-3 years ago in the budget, it's nowhere near as bad as it is. So I think, you know, I don't know. It's some combination of politics and waking up. I don't know what the combo is. That's I don't think I helped you with that, but that's kind of my... As for the market, I would say after 13 times in a row, I'm going to bet on, in the next 72 hours, they kick it somehow to November with some minor kinds, you know, they won't, any of the problems that they currently are having, and I think it's a lot of it's the Obamacare thing, none of that will get solved. There'll be enough pressure where they push it to November and we fight it again before the end of the year, because that's happened 13 times in a row, and the market's going to say business as usual, and the market's going to do what it's going to do. I'm more concerned really with this drop in payrolls this week, but did that answer help you at all, or confuse the hell out of you?
No, it actually helps me kind of tease out some of my ideas. I think this ties back to what we were just discussing. I think the political parties have now created a environment where this is par for the course, where this idea that we're going to set up these systems, we're going to have these budgets, we're going to argue back and forth, and it's an opportunity then for each party to point to the other party and say it's their fault that this isn't happening. It's their fault that teacher isn't going to get paid, even though they are going to get paid. It's their fault that somebody doesn't have internet, even though they do. It's a part of the course, and it's also a way, I think, and you tell me if I'm wrong on this, it's a way of trying to scare Americans into voting a certain way.
Oh yeah, so we do a lot of that now.
Yeah, it's a weird system that we've created, and it's been allowed to create over time, right? And it's odd. Like, it shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't be used as a scare tactic. We should at some point be able to say we're all Americans. We need to do what's right for the country, and it's. The budget is now being used almost as a weapon.
If you
hurt each other,
I don't want to walk you down this plank. So, tell me not to go there if you want. I had a couple of people send me some things in the last month or two, and it's kind of funny where people talk about capitalism, and you and I and Kevin just went through a whole routine about how capitalism. We're not talking about free market capitalism.
No.
And it's still there in a lot of industries, although I doubt if any of us could name 10. I bet we could all name 5. But in other areas, it's really become kind of crony. And the idea from, essentially from the right, is if you don't agree with this type of capitalism, you must be a socialist or something, which I'm the furthest thing from a socialist. But it's funny. I guess I had heard the term at one time. Why don't we hear more about the term plutocracy? Because we're talking about a government totally controlled by the rich for the rich. They're going to own all the communications media. It's going to be 300 people that are going to own the place, and everybody else, just no matter what side you're fighting back and forth, you're worth nothing. I mean, why doesn't everybody see that that's right where we're heading here? I don't. And it's not socialism. It's not capitalism. I mean, you're still going to have, I think, free markets and farming. You know, if you and I want to set up a barber or hairdressing type of thing or a bar, I guess that's going to be free. But once you run out of, I don't think you need to use your toes to count up the amount of free industries they still are. I mean, Kevin talked last week about how a lot of the people taking the entrepreneurial courses at Ivy are all in the restaurant, landscaping, you know, house construction kind of businesses that they still think they can, you know, have their own business in. But you're not going up the chain into manufacturing or anything like that. I mean, that's all, you know, it seems to me, let's get a $500 billion investment from, you know, someplace overseas where the president has his finger in it. And that is not my kind of capitalism, but it seems to be somebody's idea, and then people are just rolling with it. Don't say anything you don't want to say. Just, I mean, what am I missing here?
So I don't think you're wrong. And I believe that a big part of it, again, is our legal system. So you have a group of people who have been able to figure out legally how to put these rules and restrictions, and then you've got hired another group of people to defend those and to argue those. And both of these groups of people are benefiting because it reduces competition, it allows for them to compete almost by themselves. And again, we've created a system where this is accepted and tolerated. So
when you say tolerated, I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you say tolerated, do you mean people approve it, or do they just have no idea how to fight it?
No idea how to fight it. And they might not know about it. They might not know that the system exists. And if they try to start digging into it, it becomes so complicated so quickly that it's not necessarily something that they want to fight. So if you wanted to fight some of these laws that are being put into it, as a layperson without a legal or a law degree, and you start looking up the laws surrounding this, it's very difficult to understand them, let alone understand how to argue for or against.
Well, you know, without knowing that you're doing it, I'm pretty good at reading between the lines. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but you're showing a little edge towards today's legal system, not necessarily the lawyers, but I don't know if you know you are or not, but you are.
I am.
But you're doing it very well, by the way. It's like your mom telling you something where she didn't really say it, but you know exactly what she said, for God's sake. I mean, even look at the stuff like, it's a political subject, but it's not going to be, I mean, the government, essentially Trump, going after Comey. Okay, you know, I don't know whether he did this or that and the other thing. I mean, I suspect he didn't, but I don't know. But what I do know, since I spend one or two nights a week hanging around with a bunch of older attorneys, I know that if Comey tries to defend himself with his own money, he doesn't have a chance. Because the government attorneys, I'm going to say for anybody that has the balls to stand up to government in the attorney world, you're talking 10 guys at $600 an hour, easy.
Mm-hmm.
And even if Comey wins, which I suspect he probably will or get thrown out, he's going to be down $1 million even if it gets dismissed.
Even if it's dismissed.
And everybody knows I am zero fan of the man in office. But the idea that they could go after him in four or five courts at the same time and run up a $40 million legal bill, not even Trump deserves that. That's just wrong. I mean,
and again, that's the system, right?
Yeah.
And that's, and you know, I'm not criticizing the players of the system.
But there isn't a person we know. I'm hoping, you know, maybe Russell. You know, he should get a limousine. But even Russell, I'm going to say Russell's done well for himself, and he deserves to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. Let's say he's 10 times richer than I think he is. I'm not saying he's rich at all. I don't see Russell paying for a 2-week stay in a hospital without insurance, and I don't see him defending himself in any kind of a legal case with his own money. I don't see how that could possibly happen. Anybody thinks that the medical system or the law system works for you, and I don't know why I picked on poor Russell, but I'm saying I don't. You know, some of the wealthiest people I know could never withstand a federal indictment or even a hospital stay for 2 weeks.
Well, and with the federal indictment, not only are you dealing with the legal fees, but you're also dealing with reputational.
Oh, without a doubt.
You're not. How do you bounce back professionally for something like that?
You don't. A law enforcement guy being indicted, it's a tough. How do you come back from that one?
Right, exactly. It's you're done. And I think that's a product of the system, right? Once you're in the system you're being churned on, it's very difficult to come out of it and financially come out of it, emotionally come out of it. We're not even talking about the emotional distress and like the ability to show up to court every day and to take care of all of that is very challenging.
There was a guy here in Chicago, and it had something to do with, I don't know if it was a citizenry thing, it was something, but they thought he was whatever. But the guy, the dude is in jail here a year and a half, and it's constantly going back and forth to court, you know, continuance here, continuance there. How the hell does that guy get somebody to pay for that legal bill? I mean, nobody can do that. Who can do that?
Again, you can't blame the lawyers for wanting to participate in this.
Well, you know, you know, a lot of stuff we're talking about, boy, you're kind of barking up the same tree as me. People don't go into the detail of this and find out, wait a minute, how does somebody defend themselves? I mean, we talk, to me, if you haven't figured it out, to me, this is all the same subject. It all sounds like I'm jumping around sports. I mean, it's all the same subject. Where is the logic? How's this working? Is it working? And when you talk about, like, even the bail system, oh, we got to keep these guys in jail. We can't let them out. Now, obviously, somebody is going to say somebody just raped somebody and they're out of, well, which is a bad thing, obviously, and they've been in and out of jail like 8 times, okay? And you sit there and go, well, that person shouldn't have been out or something along those lines. Then you go, boy, if you were in my neighborhood, you'd be there every Tuesday, Wednesday talking to these judges and lawyers because you'd love it. They'll say, well, you know, one of the lawyers tells me, you know, I win 75% of my cases. And it's a year and a half between the guy gets arrested and there's a trial. How do 75% of the people spend a year and a half in jail and then they're found not guilty? How do you do that to somebody?
And then how do you not compensate them?
Yeah, how do you...
That's something else that blows my mind is these people, they're not given retroactive salaries, right?
No.
Their 401ks aren't stocked and they're not getting prepped for retirement. How do they get into a decent job afterwards? We're not setting these people up for success.
Well, I've on a few times, and now you, since this is kind of what you teach, one state, and I'd love to maybe boy get somebody out, one state sort of does that, and it's Nevada. If you're in jail there, you I think you have to have some kind of a trade, for lack of a better term, some chance of getting a job when you get out of there, or else they know you're going to be right back.
Right.
And now here, and in other states, and I don't know what it's like in Indiana, the idea is that's way too expensive. Now, if you go to county jail, I would bet 20 or 25% of the people there, and I just take pulling this right out of my behind, doctor, are probably hardened at a point where, you know, if you're capable of murdering somebody, I don't know that you ever can bring that bus around to where, you know, that person, even as a Catholic, we are supposed to think that everybody's redeemable. I don't know that everybody is, but let's say 20% aren't.
Wait, you can be redeemable and still a danger to society.
Right, right. I very well said. But the rest of the people, even if you learn how to change brakes or change oil to where when you get out of there, you can go over to Jiffy Lube and get a job, there's a pretty good chance you're not coming back, I would hope, or at least less of a chance than if you don't have anything like that. Not disparaging anybody who works at Jiffy Lube. But the idea is it's always too expensive to do that. But I wonder if we drop this project on Dr. Ademiak and her class to work on for a semester, I might bet that if you took a 10-year horizon instead of 1-year horizon, that Dr. Ademiak and her class might come back and say, in the long run, you're saving money. But
well, even if we're not saving money, in the long run, we're saving people.
Yeah, but nobody cares about that, except you and me.
Well, I do.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, you and I do.
Let me be very clear. Yeah. I get very deeply about these. Because you're saving, the person who was in jail so that they're not coming back. You're potentially saving a violent crime. You're helping the entire family, the family ecosystem that was of that family member who was in jail, because it doesn't just impact the person who is in prison. It impacts so many people around them, that your entire orbit of world. If this is a man or a woman who have children, who have spouses, who have parents, who have brothers and sisters, who have friends, all of these people are impacted by this person in jail, let alone the person who the violent crime was committed against, right? So there is something to be said for really making sure our society is better.
Help me here. You're a man and a genius. I always thought exactly like you think in terms of that regard. Now, the more I do research on stuff and I see what's happening right now and how people could care less if Hispanic people are harassed everywhere right now. And I go back in our history, clearly there was slavery. And I actually dug up a law from 1882 about all the Chinese people that were here and the railroad was done being built. We got to get these people the hell out of here. We don't want them here. It's not new. And, you know, the same thing happened in Europe. I mean, the Italians did it under Mussolini. Hitler decided the Jewish people were the enemy. Somehow or another, is that what we're really like? I mean, they interviewed some guy from Oak Lawn, which is right near where I grew up, the other day, and I could just sort of tell he's this old white guy. We got to do whatever it takes to get these people out of here. They're causing all these problems. Who's he talking about? I mean, did a few criminals, not a few, but some, pile over the border that we probably have to deal with because we had a few more people came across over a few years than before? Maybe. Probably. But does that mean everybody who speaks Spanish is guilty till proven innocent? We seem like we're going down this road awful easy. I'm just wondering, you and I are on the same page that you help people just because they're people. I wonder how many people are with us, I guess is my question.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, what's the real America? I'm sitting here, an old guy sitting here managing money for people and trying to tell some truth on the show. I don't know if I'm preaching to the right people or I say right or the left. I don't know if anybody has any idea, or does anybody other than you and me give a crap whether we really help somebody in jail and he doesn't come back? You do, I do. I think a lot of people do, but I'm not so sure about the percentages anymore.
I also think that people don't feel that they have a voice.
Oh, we don't.
Or that there's anything that can actually be done about it. And again, I think that's a bigger problem in our society. If you don't feel like you can say something, if you don't feel like, even if you do get your voice out there, that something will be done, then you're in a challenging situation where you almost have that apathetic feeling where you thought, well, okay, well, it's not my problem, so I'm not going to worry about it.
Well, because it's you, I want to run over a minute. And I want to ask you a question I've asked pretty much everybody the last couple of weeks, and I'm going to get a good point of view. Coming from the trading floor, and I mentioned earlier, it was a total bastard creation that the people in New York never wanted. You're supposed to just buy stock, pay a lot of money to do it, and you're not supposed to have any of this option stuff, right? Okay. So we started a trading floor where there's a bunch of people. There's 1,000 people in a room. And the first thing people would say, they've got to be a bunch of thieves in there, right? Well, it turns out they weren't. We weren't. Could have been the most honest place they've ever been, but there was a reason for that. Nobody wanted to be tarred with the brush that they were a bunch of crooks. So we policed ourselves to an extreme, an absolute extreme, because nobody wanted the headline that they're stealing on the Chicago Board Options Exchange floor, because it was everybody's livelihood. So you didn't have to tell us to stop people from screwing up. We knew that. My question is, if Dr. Demiak gets made a representative or a senator, which I'd love to see someday, how do you, with your point of view, and I can just tell you're one of the most honest people I've ever probably met, how do you get in the Senate, see all these other people taking all this money from everybody, trading all damn day? How do you put up with it knowing you're being tarred with the same brush? I never would. They'd have me out of there in a second. I'd say, here's a list of 10 of you idiots that are trading all day. Knock it off, because I don't want people accusing me of doing it, because I'm not doing it. How is it that they don't seem to care? I mean, I think they care. I mean, how does Dick Durbin sit there? And I think Dick's a pretty honest guy. Whether he's the greatest center or not, I don't know. There's never been any accusation of him taking cash from here and here. How does he sit there in that den of thieves all day and not say, clean it up?
I couldn't argue for somebody who does that. I would have a hard time staying quiet.
Well, me too. I don't see how you, because everybody I talk to, every younger person go, well, they're all a bunch of crooks anyway. And I said, well, they're not all a bunch of crooks.
Right.
Name me one that, I mean, it's why would you let the disdain for politicians envelop the place where you are elected and try and do a good job? Boy, I would be the loudest person there. They couldn't wait to get me out of there.
Well, and again, I think that it comes back to, if you don't have a voice, if you're economically dependent on the situation and economically unstable, because when do these things, you mentioned Hitler and Mussolini, these things occur because people are economically, they don't have food. So if we don't have our basic needs met, we're going to be in situations where we allow these things to happen because we're hungry. Yeah. And this gets back to the idea that, what do we do for the people who are in jail? Well, we make sure that when they get out of jail, that they're not hungry. Because you're a lot less motivated to hurt somebody or try to take something from somebody else, the haves versus the have-nots, if you're not hungry, right? I mean,
well, next time you're on, let's talk about white-collar crime, because they're not hungry. Right. Well, they're not hungry, and yet they're just as anxious for the next illegal buck as the first one.
But you don't know that they're not hungry.
Well, they're hungry for something.
Hungry for something.
not for dinner tonight. That's for Doctor. I love it. So whenever you want to pile on with Russell, feel free. You are welcome all the time. And
days,
if I ever be heading down to the cornfields, I'm going to stop for breakfast or something. If you'll have a coffee with me, I'd love to meet you. I think it's spectacular. But
yeah, no, that sounds great.
We're not going to bring Russell though. He's out. He's out. That guy, because he'll want to go to McDonald's. You know, it's the only place he goes, McDonald's. That guy. What can you say?
Yep, I can't argue one or the other on that.
I mean, I like McDonald's, but every day, anyway, I love giving Russell grief. By the way, has he got any new cardigans? Have you seen any?
Well, I don't know. I have not seen Russell's cardigans recently.
Oh, when he used to come in the office in the wintertime, he had a new one on every week. We give him no
money. Always looks nice.
He always looks nice. Anyway, love him, love you. You take care of yourself. SP Futures down 27, NASDAQ Futures down 111. Maybe next week we'll talk about whether we still have a shutdown. Why don't you plan on penciling us in next week so we can talk about it. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.